Welcome. This is Burt White, as a part of the LPL Research Group, and I'm the Chief Investment Officer. And Peter, I think you've got maybe a welcoming that maybe you could start off with.
Very good, Burt. Good morning, everybody. This is Peter Tedstrom with Tedstrom Wealth Advisors. I believe all of you know me, and if you don't, it's nice to meet you virtually. Today we have the good fortune of having Burt White and John Lynch with us from LPL, and many of you have met Burt over the years at some of our conferences and seminars that we've held in the past. We have some reverberation in our audio here. I want to just check that for a moment, so hold on. Bear with us. We have a little technical difficulty. Okay. No. How's that? Okay. Got it. Excuse the delay there. Anyway, we are quite fortunate to have Burt and John with us today. And since we've had quite a year in the markets and the economy and the political environment, we thought it would be valuable and helpful to have a perspective or provide a perspective on 2018 in review and looking ahead to 2019. If you have questions along the way, please email them to me at peterT@tedstromwealth.com, peterT@tedstromwealth.com. And I'll forward those questions on to Burt and John during the presentation so they can answer those questions. If questions come up later in the presentation and we don't have a chance to answer them, we'll make sure those questions get answered individually for you following this this webinar. So I'll turn it over to Burt and John. Thank you, guys.
Awesome. Thank you, Peter. Hello, everybody. I will tell you that that echo was orchestrated by me largely to illustrate the recent volatility in the marketplace. But hopefully the removal of that echo is also indicative of the fact that maybe we'll not have as much volatility going forward. But good golly, who knows? Hello, John. How are you?
I'm great, Bert. How are you?
So I'm John and I are lucky enough to lead a team of a bunch of research analysts here at LPL, and what we do is we work with Peter in thinking through what the market looks like, what the economy looks like. And we're going to give you a little snapshot as to where we've been, what we're living in right now, and maybe more importantly, kind of where it's headed. And John's going to do most of the driving here today. I'm going to be a backseat driver, occasionally interrupting and doing some color commentary. The thought is, John, what we're going to talk for 20, 25 minutes or so, go all over the world and talk about all kinds of stuff, and then we'll answer a couple questions.
Terrific. Thank you, Burt. Thank you, Peter. And good morning, everybody. Appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts with you. Obviously, been a very difficult period for investors. I remind everyone that we were at record levels in the equity markets a mere 3 months ago. And in the fourth quarter, everything just dropped off a cliff. We had uncertainty relative to the midterm elections. Then we had uncertainty relative to interest rates and the direction of monetary policy that the Federal Reserve was going through, concern about oil prices, trade tensions, a variety of things hit the markets. And if you see here on this slide, 2018 U.S. equity performance had been markets had been strong, again, at record levels through the end of the third quarter. And then the fourth quarter, unfortunately, we saw a major, major pullback. Russell 2000 index and the NASDAQ composite have since slipped into a bear market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 have not. On an intraday basis on Christmas Eve, the S&P did slip into a bear market as defined by a 20% decline, but I need to make the distinction for it to be a bear market, a 20% decline, it has to be a closing price. And why that's important is because a lot of the computer trading programs that will hit the bid down 20%. So the S&P, which is perhaps the most popular index, did not slip into recession, bear market rather, but nonetheless, it's been a very, very painful period for investors because not only did the equity markets pull back, we saw weakness in bonds, we saw weakness in some commodities as well. So what we'd like to provide for you today is some perspective relative to why things happened and what we see going forward. When looking at the year ahead, we intentionally named our 2019 market outlook fundamental, how to focus on what really matters in the markets. And we really wrote this in conjunction with our talented marketing team. You know, Bert and I are in charge of all the geeks and research, and then Bert has responsibility for some of the marketing people, for all the marketing people as well, and they're the talented and creative ones. And it's always a good marriage at LPL Research and LPL Financial because you get the geeks and the creative types, and we come up with an excellent report that we believe, you know, we don't want it to be such an academic piece that it doesn't resonate. We want to make sure it's actionable. We want to make sure it's understandable and processable for investors, if processable is a word. Don't play me in Scrabble, Bert.
Yeah.
On the outlook, though, it's really important to focus on the fundamentals. And I understand, you know, we had that echo chamber a minute ago. I don't want to sound like an echo chamber for you today, emphasizing focus on the fundamentals when the markets have been through such a difficult period. But it's very important for all of you to appreciate the fact that the market can be weak without the economy being weak. We believe the economy is going to slow but continue to grow. We think the Fed is going to raise rates, but not as much as the market had feared. We think profits are going to continue to grow, just not as fast as in 2018. We think ultimately we'll get a trade agreement if the disappointing report from that leading technology company yesterday was any indication. China needs to have a deal on trade faster than we need to have a deal on trade. So we think that also can lead to progress. So when focusing on the fundamentals, excuse me, I get so choked up talking about this stuff. When focusing on the fundamentals, we like to emphasize four key areas for our investors, whether you think about policy, the economy, fixed income or bonds or equities or stocks. And when you look at those four areas, today we'll try and provide perspective for you as to how we believe, again, the economy can avoid recession in 2019. We want to be respectful of the fact that recession can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? We can scare ourselves into recession, but when you see positive reports like today's jobs number, which I'll get into in a little bit, that provides what we believe a firmer foundation for the economy, ultimately for policy decisions, which we believe will be enacted to continue the expansion. We're going to have recession someday. We always do. We just think the fundamentals are too great right now and the foundation is too strong for it to occur in 2019. So with that, looking at policy first and foremost, you all may remember that midterm election that everyone was so worried about. I think it's important for investors to recognize it's not necessarily who's in the White House. It's about the composition of government. You know, the founding fathers had it right when they talked about divided government and the different branches of government. And what we did here was we looked at the makeup of Congress, upper and lower house, and we found that when you have a Republican president with a divided house, a Republican Senate and a Democratic Congress, the average annual return for the market is 15.7%. I also think it's important, and Bert and I have talked about this quite a bit, you're going to have issues like immigration taking headlines, trade taking headlines. It's important for investors to appreciate that now that the campaigning is done, governing, I don't know necessarily believe governing has begun yet, but governing is about to begin. And I think both parties are far closer on trade than they indicated during the recession, during the campaign season. I think both parties are closer together on infrastructure spending than they indicated during during the campaign season. What we have to be mindful of is debt ceiling debate, budget battles. It's conceivable that the corporate tax rate, which went from 35% to 21%, I suspect, and Bert and I and the team have worked on this quite a bit, we want to prepare our investors for the possibility of a 25% corporate tax rate on the table once the debate really picks up before the summer recess and again in the 11th hour this September. So that will cause some volatility. Clearly, Mueller investigation, that also can have some headline risk. But we always want to be mindful of, for our investors, that the composition of government tends to be a very strong one. Typically, when a sitting president loses seats, which happens all the time, the sitting president in the first midterm loses an average of 29 seats. This president lost 36 or 37 seats, so it's basically in line with average. More often than not, that president is ready to deal because that president wants to keep his job at the next election. So you typically see government priming the pump. And what we've seen since World War II is average positive returns for the S&P 500 in the 12 months following the midterm election. So I think that's important to keep in mind. Trade and tariffs are a big issue. We want to emphasize to all investors that when you look at worst case scenario for tariffs, we're looking at maybe $200 billion, maybe $250 billion hit in the coming year. But we also want to point out that the fiscal tailwinds are superior to those of tariff headwinds by a factor of 4 or 5 when you figure in tax cuts, government spending, also the contribution from repatriated or foreign source profits that can come back to the U.S. at a reduced tax rate. So if you purely look at tax cuts and government spending, in 2018, that was about $350 billion, which on a $20 trillion economy, that's about 1.5% of GDP. You are seeing headlines this morning about the waning effects of fiscal stimulus, and we think those are incorrect because in our calculations, when you look at consumer relief, government spending, and small business relief, that's 2.1% or $435 billion or so in fiscal tailwinds, offsetting the tariff headwinds. And then when you bring in repatriated assets and the possibility for improved lending capacity as the stress is reduced on stress tests for the major banks, we think you know, that $430 billion number could essentially be doubled when you factor in repatriated assets as well. So be mindful that fiscal tailwinds are superior to that of tariff headwinds. And here's a very sophisticated chart that we have relative to interest rates. And we did an analysis suggesting interest rates peaked when Paul Volcker was head of the Federal Reserve in 1980. Those of you who are more seasoned investors, remember that Paul Volcker was about 6'8", and interest rates were 18%. Alan Greenspan was 6'1", 6'2". Interest rates came down. Ben Bernanke was about 5'7". And Janet Yellen was about 3 feet tall in heels. And we had record low interest rates at that time. And what we're proud to say, speaking today, Fed Chair Jerome Powell is an average size male. And we're looking for interest rates to go no higher than historically average levels over the next few years. And the reason for that is because even though the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates for 3 years now, they began raising rates from zero in December of 15. So that's over 3 years. We've seen 8 or 9 hikes over that time period. And what we've seen, when you adjust for inflation, what we call real or inflation-adjusted interest rates, are next to zero. So the market has said the Fed is raising too much, but when you look at an analysis like this, the Fed will say rates are still accommodative and we have to agree. But what's different, and you never want to say what's different this time, but what's different is not only have investors become accustomed to free money over the past decade, the Federal Reserve is gradually raising interest rates, but they're also doing a thing called balance sheet runoff. They created a lot of money, if you will, with working with Treasury over the past decade, helped interest rates maintain that zero level, but they bought a lot of assets in the meanwhile. They bought a lot of Treasury bonds in the meanwhile. As they let those Treasury bonds, which are maturing, roll off their balance sheet, what that means for you is that forces up market interest rates. So the Fed has to be very careful because it's not a traditional tightening cycle. Even though they're saying it's gradual tightening, there's a two-pronged approach. They are raising the federal funds rate, which is the overnight lending rate, but they are also allowing market interest rates to rise. And why that's important for you is because that's affecting your auto financing, that's affecting your home financing, and to the degree that gets too high, you're not going to buy that next car, you're not going to buy that next home. And when you multiply that by 300 million Americans or 330 million Americans, that's how the economy can slow down, and we don't think the Fed wants to take it to that level. Another analysis shows interest rates relative to economic growth. Don't want to get too heady here, but the bottom line is it's just another indication that we are about 300 or three full percentage points below where we need to be given where traditional policy would dictate. So Fed Chair Jerome Powell today is speaking, and he's suggesting that rates won't be as threatening as the market has feared, particularly over these last 8 or 10 weeks. Now, taking those policy decisions, okay, we think that government will be supportive for government spending. We think the Federal Reserve will be less aggressive than the market fears. And we also think you're going to see some infrastructure spending. And we also think you're going to see, I don't want to say resolution to the China trade tensions, but a path to progress relative to China trade tensions will be sufficient in our estimation to get economic growth moving again and ultimately the financial markets. Looking at our economic forecasts, we grew about 3% in the U.S. in 2018. That data is not complete yet. We should know that over the next 8 to 10 weeks, but call it 2.9 or 3%. We believe that the economy will slow, but gradually, and we're calling it at the low end 2.5% U.S. economic output. Now, when we see GDP, we're talking about gross domestic product. That's total output of all goods and services. That's your consumption. That is businesses investing. That's government spending, and that's trade. So that all factors into economic growth calculations, and a 2.5% rate of growth is a good pace. It is better than the pace over the past decade. Yet it's about an average pace of growth when you think about long-term averages. Global growth also moderating somewhat. We see a little more weakness in Europe than we do in the emerging space. So we're looking at, call it, 3.5 to 3.75% growth in global GDP. My friend Bert White sitting right here pays me to worry, and I am not losing sleep on inflation. We see that even though the Fed has printed all this money and kept interest rates at zero, we only see inflation growing about a 2.5% pace of growth in 2019. Historically, inflation has to be growing north of 4% before the Federal Reserve gets scared and really slams on the brakes to slow down growth. Many of you are concerned about oil prices. Oil, as you know, has fallen dramatically. The price of WTI crude is in a bear market. It's fallen more than 20% from its peak late September, early October. We believe that is a function not of fears of slowing global demand or slowing global growth. We think that is a function of increased supply. Again, you never want to say it's different this time, but it is different this time now that the U.S. is the world's largest producer, essentially rendering OPEC ineffective. As if they ever were effective in setting prices. But nonetheless, when you see the weakness in oil down to the $46, $47 range this morning, we believe that oil can finish up the year and hover in that $57.50 to $62.50, call it a $60 type range 12 months out. OPEC has already agreed to production cuts that will be put into effect in this first quarter. We think that will have support for prices. And as the U.S. Moderates output somewhat, we don't think the U.S. is going to slow down too much, but I think you're going to see Saudi and Russia, because they really, they, countries like that need oil to be north of $50 so they can support their government spending programs. So again, oil is more of a supply issue as opposed to a demand issue. With that 2.5% forecast in the U.S. economy, we thought it was important to maintain this chart for investors, because you're going to see articles saying we're peaking in manufacturing. And we looked at the last five business cycles, and over the last five business cycles, we had a 14-year peak in manufacturing in August and September. The manufacturing report yesterday for December was a disappointment. It was lower than expected, but it was still in expansion territory. But even if last month represented the peak in manufacturing, history shows that it takes almost 4 years for manufacturing, a peak in manufacturing, before the economy slips into recession. And we also found that over that four-year period, while it's not a straight line, the S&P 500 has grown by more than 50% on a cumulative basis over that four-year period. So we want to make sure our investors understand that economic growth is slowing. We think the foundations for employment, business investment, personal consumption, manufacturing, services activity, we believe that foundation is strong enough to withstand the market sentiment, which obviously has plunged over these last 10 weeks or so. So when you're in your darkest moments thinking about the markets, think about the foundation that we see here in the economy. Again, we respect the fact that recession can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, but that is exceedingly rare. And when you see a jobs number like we saw today, when Wall Street consensus was projecting 175,000 jobs to be created last month, and we saw the economy produce 312,000 jobs, we think that is a very, very positive development supporting our outlook. Moving over to interest rates and fixed income, there's been a lot of concern about the Treasury yield curve flattening. What that means is the interest rate differential between two-year Treasuries and 10-year Treasury bonds has narrowed. Historically, when the two-year Treasury is higher than the 10-year, that typically is a signal that the economy is going to slip into recession. We don't believe the Fed wants to take interest rates to a point where they cause recession. They just want to make sure inflation is not a threat. So we want to point out that historically, when we've seen flattening yield curves, typically it's taken about 4 years between a flattening and a recession to occur. And again, the market is up by more than two-thirds over those experiences. But again, that is not a straight line when that occurs. So since we believe the Fed does not want to cause recession, we think they're going to be less aggressive this year than feared. And even though corporate bonds, their yields have widened relative to treasuries in recent weeks, I want to point out that they've widened only to historically average levels. Certainly on the investment grade front, a little wider than historically average on high yield bonds. And why that's important, high yield bonds, as those yields rise, that's an indicator of which companies are too weak to service their debt interest payments. And those could be companies that may end up defaulting. While the Fed was just beginning an interest rate tightening cycle, we thought it was prudent to make sure investors had exposure to the high yield market. We're pulling a lot of that back now, and we are going to be looking, and you will see in your portfolios, more investment grade credits, companies, if you will, that are more likely willing to service their debt payments in a slowing economic environment, but it's still a good economic environment. To the degree that, going back to policy for a second, to the degree that policy is in a situation in Washington where we see that the state and local tax deductions is put back into place, you will likely see us increasing exposure to the municipal space in your portfolios as well. We still believe Treasury should have some exposure in portfolios. As you know, the bond market's been in a bull market for 35 years now. It has to end sometime. But we still believe that Treasuries can provide investment portfolios in a diversified strategy with income, with liquidity. When I talk about liquidity, I'm talking about the freedom to trade because there's enough cash behind it, as well as a source of or an ability to smooth out volatility when the equity markets go through periods of turmoil like they have been recently. Treasury bonds have held up relatively well despite the Treasury market weakness in recent weeks. So moving to equities, you're going to see a lot of headlines as to whether or not this is the longest bull market in history. To the degree it started in March 9th, 2009, when the S&P 500 opened up at a devilishly low 666, we've seen the S&P rise by about 250% over that period. It had been as high as 300%. I don't want investors to get too caught up as to when the bull started. Was it in 2009 after the market troughed? Was it in 2013 when the equity market hit a new high? Or was it in 2016 when equity indices finally started outperforming bond indices during this cycle? So the point there is not to get too caught up on the duration or length of this expansion. We want you to get caught up in the magnitude of the expansion. And what we believe drives the magnitude of expansion is corporate profits. And as corporate profits continue to grow, we think that is an important dynamic. So when the equity market is defined by the S&P 500, we've got a chart here saying S&P 500 impossible bear. In October, November, and December, before the line falls off a cliff, we were forming what's known as a triple bottom. Fortunately, the market typically views a triple bottom as final support for the market to take off again. We broke through a triple bottom in early December, which was why the S&P at its worst fell 19.8% from the recent high. This morning, we're trading around 2,500 or so before I came into this conference room. We've improved about 6 or 7% from that low on Christmas Eve. And, yes, today's jobs report certainly is a number that can help support that market. But when you have such severe technical damage, when I talk technicals, I'm referring to price and charting patterns, price and volume patterns. When I talk fundamentals, I'm talking about earnings and interest rates. When you have that sort of technical damage, it takes a while to repair. And that's why a message we're driving to our investors is that it's possible to have a bear market or a bear market environment, say market down 19% from peak and not necessarily a 20% pullback, but nonetheless, you can have a bear without recession. We've had 14 bears over the last, 1950, over the last 60 or 70 years. Of those 14 bears, only 7 resulted in recession. So when you look at the last 5 bear markets without recession, the average decline was 20%, which is basically where we were last week. So we believe if we're not close to the bottom, if we're not at the bottom, we are very close to the bottom. And a point that we really want to emphasize here to help you, again, during tumultuous days in the markets as we're trying to repair that technical damage, we looked at the last 10 earnings cycles, and you will see headlines as earnings are reported over the next handful of weeks that earnings have peaked. And I want you to make the distinction that earnings growth has peaked, okay, because earnings will grow 20 to 25% in 2018. In 2019, they'll grow 6 to 8%. 6 to 8% is a slower rate of growth than 20 to 25%. But it is still growth. It is historically average growth or slightly above historically average growth off the record level from next year. So be very mindful that the rate of growth may be declining, but growth is still occurring. So I want you to think about earnings and the markets, record profits growing at or slightly above historically average rates yet we're discounting those profits at below average interest rates. And we look at the last 10 cycles, it took 4 years from a peak in earnings growth. Even if last quarter was the peak, history shows it takes 4 years before the economy to slip into recession, and the market is up by 50% over that time period. So how do we invest in that environment? We want to make sure we're focused on companies that have sound balance sheets and companies that are delivering good earnings growth. And it's not just individual companies, it's sectors, it's industries, and it's regions, whether we're looking at the U.S., Europe, and Japan, which we would characterize as developed markets, or the emerging markets like China and India and Brazil, for example. And when we look at profits, the U.S. was obviously the most superior in 2018. In 2019, we're looking for emerging markets to deliver the strongest period of earnings growth, followed by the U.S. and then by Europe. So we will invest accordingly. We're going to overweight the U.S. We're going to overweight emerging markets. We're going to underweight Europe because we're very concerned about the political situation there. We're concerned about Italian budget. We're concerned about the possibility of no Brexit deal, and consequently that obviously will affect developed market growth. So we will continue to overweight the U.S. and emerging relative to developed markets. We are going to overweight large caps relative to small. We are going to continue to fight the fight for value relative to growth and chip away at that lead growth has had. And we will look at emerging markets overdeveloped. And when we look at these developed markets, they clearly have been in a weak trend as well. Japan likely has further gains over the next 6 months or so, but be mindful that Japan has a consumption tax that kicks in the fourth quarter of this year. So we will lighten our exposure to Japan probably the end of this first half of 2019 in anticipation of that. And again, we're going to underweight Europe during this period because of our concerns about nationalism, Italian budgets, as well as the possibility for a no-deal Brexit. And then finally, within the emerging markets, we think they've done an extraordinary job adjusting to the transition in China's growth from a 10% rate to a 6% rate. We think they've done a very good job embracing services and consumption in their economies as opposed to the traditional export-driven manufacturing economies that they had been using. And consequently, that's why we see stronger earnings growth in the emerging space. This final slide is really, I guess we can call it a shameless self-promotion, but the whole idea there is just to let you know that LPL Research is available to help you. LPLResearch.com, LPL Research blog, our 2019 outlook. We have a podcast. We have two blogs daily. We have weekly reports. We have this Outlook 2019, which has a lot of collateral that can help investors really try to focus on the fundamentals during tumultuous periods like we've experienced. So with that, I think I'll take a deep breath, Bert.
Yeah.
And, you can say where I've been wrong.
Yeah, but then basically we have to do the whole thing over.
Sorry, okay.
A couple things that I would say, and then we'll want to see if Peter has some questions for us, but a couple things that I'd say. The first thing is I oftentimes like to talk about knowing where you are. You got to know where you are at any point in time. And one of the examples I oftentimes give is, you know, if you're going down the road and you see a sign and it says, bridge ices over quickly. Well, that sign means a lot more in January than it does in August. And if you know where you are, you know what those signs mean. And so when you see a market that drops 20% or so, you got to understand where you are in the context of the economic cycle, where you are with earnings, where you are with employment. And that gives you the context of understanding whether or not this is icy in January, or is this a sign that talks about iciness in August, which isn't a concern at all. And it's never quite that clear when you're thinking about the markets. But I think for us, as we begin to look at this volatility, we think this is a little bit more of the icy sign in August. Doesn't mean there can't be ice on the bridge. I guess an ice truck could have dumped ice on the bridge, and there could be ice there.
Unlikely. But knowing where you are, and I think our viewpoint is in this economic cycle, we are not at the end of it, and the end of it is what we would refer to as a recession. And the last piece is just knowing the volatility is normal. As John talked about, you know, there's a big difference between the market and the economy. And the market is subject to changing confidence. The market is the combination of all investors together. And so when a whole lot of people get nervous, the market gets nervous. That is what they are, right? And we as humans are nervous folks. That's why the market has lots of volatility to it. The economy, however, is a little different. And while you can get nervous, it takes a lot to not buy a car. It takes a lot to cancel your cell phone. It takes a lot to not buy Netflix. It takes a lot to not go on vacation. Now, those things happen in recessions. And that happened now. And for those of you that went, you know, holiday shopping, you saw that it was a little busy to get a parking spot. You saw it's hard to get a restaurant seat on Friday at 7 o'clock. Those things are not the case in 2008 and 2009, right? And so understanding where you are and what that means, and there's a big difference between the market and the economy. So let us pause there. I think John, you gave a lot of great technical details and a lot of vantage points on there. Peter, why don't we turn it over to you and maybe see if you have a couple of questions for either John or I.
Very good. Thank you guys very much. And to our listeners, a reminder that if you do have a question, send it to my email at petert@tedstromwealth.com. And one question that came through is, we often hear that the markets hate uncertainty. What would impeachment mean?
Uncertainty. Impeachment would mean that you have a different president.
Well, no.
Okay, good.
You can, right.
Oh, no, you got the technical definition. Yeah.
And then, as we learned in recent history, you can have impeachment and still have the same president.
You certainly can.
Because it comes down to a vote. I think when thinking about impeachment, it's just another layer of uncertainty that can affect sentiment without affecting the economic fundamentals. And that's, you know, Bert just made that great distinction, which you're always so good at, from the standpoint of you're going to have a negative headline about impeachment. Regardless of where you lean politically, that will have an impact on sentiment. But does that affect the restaurant at 7 o'clock on a Friday night? Does that affect the parking lot at the mall on a Saturday afternoon? Does that affect your wage growth potential in a fully employed economy? Unlikely. So we just need to be very mindful when you have late cycle performance like we're experiencing now, particularly when we have had interest rates at zero for a decade, that all adds to the equation. That's going to add to further volatility. So as Peter knows, we've been talking about increased volatility for 16, 18 months now. But as we showed you on those charts about a flattening yield curve, a peak in profit growth, not a peak in profits, but a peak in profit growth, as well as a peak in manufacturing, history has shown you get about 4 years and significant market gains. Again, not a straight line, but you have that opportunity to maintain that diversified portfolio that Peter has worked so diligently to arrive at for you. So we think that's really important. So will market volatility increase? Absolutely. Will it affect your portfolio over the next 3, 5, 7, or 10 years? No.
Very good. Thank you. Next question that came up is, are there any signs out there that contradict your no recession forecast?
Constantly, every day. That's why it's so humbling doing what we do. You know, we talk about fundamentals, focusing on the fundamentals, and we see the technicals crumbling. So there are constant signs there. But what fundamental signs I'll be looking for, and Bert and I and our team will be debating, which we do on just about a daily basis, is wage growth. And to the degree wages grow 4, 4.5%. They're only growing at 3 now. To the degree personal consumption still hovers in that 2.5% average annual growth rate, to the degree businesses are investing at a 5% pace, to the degree that overall revenue gains are in that 5 or 7% pace, Those are the fundamentals we're paying attention to. Impeachment can cause you to take your eye off the ball, but when you look at those fundamentals, as well as interest rates and the yield curve, we think the Fed's going to be very mindful of that. You know, we showed you that chart that had Paul Volcker going all the way down to Janet Yellen with the degree of interest rates and the height of the Fed chair. Fed Chair Powell and Paul Volcker are the only two Fed chairs in that diagram that don't have PhDs in economics. Why that's important is that they were both market savvy guys and they paid attention to market signals, and we think that ultimately will help the economy.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing that I would, you know, I would just add to that, Peter, is that, look, there's hundreds and thousands and millions of data points. And at any point, someone can circle a data point and say, see. And what we want to do is we want to find the confluence of all of them, right? And so one of the things that makes me, that gives me credence is that when John shows you a data point that says, it indicates that maybe you have another 4 years to go. And then you show another one and it indicates you have another 4 years to go. And you get another one and it indicates another 4 years to go. And what we begin to do is you begin to string together several of these. Now, anyone, we too, can pull up any one or two or three or four that would tell a different story, right? But I think our belief is that you pull those together. The second thing we'd say is that, you know, by and large, what causes the ends of markets is excesses, right? Things get too out of control. Spending gets out of control. Borrowing gets out of control. Hiring gets out of control. What's that?
Confidence
get out of control. I mean, there's tons of things that get out of control. And all those things end up driving the end of those. And I think if you go and look at what are the things that are out of control now, that are sort of at excesses, it's hard to find a lot of them. And what a lot of people miss is that the market has, to some degree, stabilizers that happen over time. Just think of this as an example. One of the big things that people were most worried about 6 months ago, John, was valuations. They said that the market's a little overvalued, that what you're paying for earnings was a little high. Well, a good old-fashioned 20% reduction in stock prices changed a lot of that, didn't it? And so now suddenly, based on a pullback, the market has actually taken off valuations as a concern now, right? And so what happens is these things that happen throughout the market, you have some built-in stabilizers. What happens is when the market, when things get to extremes, like they did in 1999 with way too much confidence and valuations got out of control, or like it did in 2007 and 8 before the Great Recession, where everyone had nine houses and all that kind of stuff, right? When you have those things happen, that's where it gets out of control, and then you don't have the stabilization, and that's when the recession sort of resets the clock. But right now, as we look at confidence and spending and borrowing and all the other component pieces, hiring and debt and everything else, we just don't see the excesses in aggregate. You see them in component pieces here and there, but not in aggregate, and that's ultimately what drives these recessions, Peter. And so I know it's a long answer to your very simple question, is there other things out there? Yes. There are plenty of things that you can circle. The question is in aggregate, do they add up to a conclusion that would tell you that you're closer to a downturn than you are continued economic growth and therefore potentially market growth? We don't see that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Peter, you know, we've used those examples. The historical examples all show 4 years from a peak, whether it's the yield curve, where it's manufacturing, or whether it's earnings growth. We think that the recession will be sooner than 4 years. In fact, we think it's a late 20, early 2021 type dynamic. So we don't want your investors to leave this call saying, you know, it's 2023. We think it'll be sooner than that, but we just think there's enough gas left in the tank for this thing to chug along through 19 and into 20.
Yeah, and last thing, I know we've beaten this answer to death, John, you and mm-hmm. I. But the last thing is, remember what John talked about. John talked about how economic growth was going to slow a little bit this year, down to 2.5%, but it was still, and that's sort of average or so long-term, maybe a little below average long-term, but it's been stronger than it has been last decade. Now think about what that means, right? What it means is that even though we had the worst recession that we've ever had, like we've never, outside of the Great Depression, we had the worst recession this economy's ever had in 2008. Usually when you have a bad recession, you have a good recovery.
This has been the slowest recovery out of any recession that we've ever had, good or bad. We had the worst recession we've ever had, and we had the worst recovery we've ever had. And even though the market's done well, up 250% or so, the economy has actually grown at 2% or so, or sub 2. And so what's happened is it's been a slow recovery. And when you have a slow recovery, think of this as like a rubber band. The faster you stretch the rubber band, the more the tension happens, and eventually it's going to snap back and create another recession. But this has been a slow pulling of the rubber band, which means that we've actually haven't overstretched things. And so this slow economy, this slow recovery that we've done the last 10 years since the Great Recession, has actually been a benefit because we haven't gotten overextended, which means it can last a little longer than normal, right? And so these are all pieces that sort of add to the puzzle that lets us, that gives us the confidence in saying that we think that this is, you know, volatile times for the market, but we believe that they will be higher values a year from now than they are today. Back to you,
Very
Peter.
Good. We have one last question, and that is, and I'm not sure how to interpret it exactly, and maybe you can. What about the excess in the top 2%?
Well, that is, you know, Bert gave a great presentation a year ago about people seeing records in the markets, but not records in their own personal economy. And I think if you view why we have Brexit, why we had the Scottish referendum, why in the last presidential election we had non-traditional candidates being so successful, is because for the decade from the Great Recession, we had unelected central bankers carrying the global economy. And that led to zero interest rates, which led to a rise in risk assets. So to your investor's question about the top 2%, the top 5% of society has exposure to risk assets. The other 95% doesn't. So the people have spoken, and the people want to no longer have central bankers carrying the economies. They want fiscal legislators who are elected to carry the global economy. That's why you're seeing fiscal stimulus, government spending plans, things along those lines. So it absolutely plays into the populism, nationalism type mentality you're seeing, particularly throughout the West.
Yeah, and the other thing I would add to that, John, is, you know, and I think you said it well, right? When you mentioned inflation, right? And a lot of times we think of inflation as you know, how much your eggs cost, and how much does bread cost, and how much does gas cost. That's a big part of inflation. But there are other big parts of inflation that's out there too, like inflation of your paycheck, like how much your wages are growing, or inflation related to your house values, or others. And one of the things that's happened, the environment that's happened, the zero interest rate environment, what it really did is it created what we would call asset inflation. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that things like your housing values, your stock prices, that appreciated dramatically. In fact, if you measure the inflation rate of stocks or the inflation rate of your home values, we have had unbelievable growth in those. The problem with that is less than half of Americans own stocks at all, and less than 15% of Americans own stocks as a large percentage of their assets. And those that do typically are in that 2% that you talked about. And so who has vast majority benefited from these economic times has really been those that can benefit most from asset-based inflation. I have a house, I have a lot of money in stocks, and that typically are those in the top 1%, 2%, 5%, right? What we haven't seen so much of the benefit is from the overall economy. Wage growth has been slow. In fact, wage growth has been, over the last decade, as slow as any decade as we've seen. And so that impacts the rank and file, median, and average American. And then that drives all the things that you talked about, John, where people begin to say, this economy has forgotten about me. I don't care what the market did. I don't care what the economic backdrop, or I don't care what the S&P 500 did. That might have been up a lot, but that doesn't cause my paycheck to go up, right? Mm-hmm. And this ends up to be that aspect you talked about in the difference between the global economy and your own personal economy. And I think there's that. So what we see is that this 2% I would go and say, and this is my personal opinion, this is not our corporate opinion, and John, you and I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but my personal opinion is one of the real, you know, social and economic aspects that we'll have to think about, and that the economy is going to have to deal with is the fact that you've got a bigger, dispersion between those that have and those that do not. And that is why. That is why. Now, politically, you know, there's different vantage points. People point fingers as to why that causes and, you know, and how to fix it and all that kind of stuff, or even if you need to fix it, right? But the reality is there is a big divergence between those two things. And I think it will have to be addressed. The one thing I will say is I don't think that component piece, we have to separate that from the market, because I don't think that has a component piece that will drive the market over the cliff. What it might do is drive our country over a cliff, maybe, depending on your view, right?
Pick your poison.
That's right, right? If I do that, you know, it could cause, you know, problems that way, or it could cause changes in elections and lots of other things, right? But it probably doesn't have a direct impact to the markets, per se, at least not over a shorter period of time. Are you going to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and that's what elections are for, right? And if you think about, if Republicans tend to be more monetarist in their thought process, when I say monetarist, more supply-driven, tax incentive-driven growth model, whereas Democrats tend to be what's known as Keynesian or more government-driven or demand-driven policies, you know, you look throughout history, one party rarely leads for three presidential elections because the pendulum typically swings too far. So I made the comment earlier about the founding fathers had it right. We never allow the pendulum to swing too far in one direction or another.
Yeah. So John and I, we have to make money regardless of whether or not who's in president, you know, who the president is, who Congress is, right? So for us, we're relatively apolitical. What we really care about is just making sure that we got a handle on the Congress. So, hey, Peter, back to you.
Very good, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Thank you, John Lynch and Bert White, for a very informative and insightful perspective on the markets and the economy. I want to thank everybody who's listening today. If you have friends or business associates that you'd like to introduce to this program or this presentation, we are going to be sending it out by email, the copies of the slides and the recording. So pay attention to your email boxes, and it will also be on our website here in the next few days. And I want to remind all of you out there, our clients know this, and that is the most important message that we want to present to you any given day when we're working together, is that you need to have a plan, and having a plan allows you to stay the course and keep your cool during these very challenging times. We've had questions from clients over the last couple of weeks. Should we change our portfolio allocation and become more conservative? Well, that's a question that's really not and shouldn't be related to market conditions, but should more be related to your willingness to take risk, your time horizon, and your perspective on your overall goals and objectives. So keep your cool, hang in there, everything's gonna be all right, and we're happy to address any specific questions that you might have following this presentation in a phone call or an email. Thank you all very much, and I hope you all have a happy new year.
Important disclosures. The opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide or be construed as providing specific investment advice or recommendations for any individual security. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted. All indexes are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. Unmanaged index returns do not reflect fees, expenses, or sales charges. Index performance is not indicative of the performance of any investment. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risks, including possible loss of principal. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee return or eliminate risk in all market environments. To the extent you are receiving investment advice from a separately registered independent investment advisor, please note that LPL Financial is not an affiliate of and makes no representation with respect to such entity. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. Yield curve is a line that plots the interest rates at a set point in time of bonds having equal credit quality but differing maturity dates. The most frequent reported yield curve compares the 3-month, 2-year, 5-year, and 30-year Treasury debt. This yield curve is used as a benchmark for other debt in the market, such as mortgage rates or bank lending rates. The curve is also used to predict changes in economic output and growth. The Consumer Price Index, or CPI, is a measure of the average change over time in the prices paid by urban consumers for a market basket of consumer goods and services. Gross Domestic Product, or GDP, is the monetary value of all of the finished goods and services produced within a country's borders in a specific time period, though GDP is usually calculated on an annual basis. It includes all of private and public consumption, government outlays, investments, and exports, less imports that occur within a defined territory. Index definitions. The S&P 500 index is a capitalization-weighted index of 500 stocks designed to measure performance of the broad domestic economy through changes in the aggregate market value of 500 stocks representing all major industries. The modern design of the S&P 500 stock index was first launched in 1957. All performance back to 1928 incorporates the performance of the predecessor index, the S&P 90. The Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index is a broad-based flagship benchmark that measures the investment-grade, U.S. dollar-denominated, fixed-rate taxable bond market. The index includes treasuries, government-related and corporate securities, MBS, agency, fixed rate in hybrid, ARM pass-throughs, ABS, and CMBS, agency and non-agency. This research material has been prepared by LPL Financial LLC, securities offered through LPL Financial LLC.